you may have seen, is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Actors, right? The road to fame and celebrity. All right, I get it. You've had an incredible life.
Aren't you sick of hearing about them?
Me too.
The only problem is, I'm one of them. Except I'm not famous. Oh, you've probably seen me. A bunch of times. I'm the guy with the information about the hero's dad. I'm the doctor that can't figure out what's wrong with one of the main characters. I'm the guy they just punched in the face during the interrogation. My name's Brian LaFontaine, and I'm a professional actor. Oh, and it's not just me. There's a ton of us.
We're the ones you don't hear about.
Yeah, we're the names that scroll by at lightning speed during the end credits. But there's way more of us than there are of them. We're important too, dammit. Because without us, they can't tell the rest of the story. So this is for all the movie and TV prostitutes, homeless people, drug dealers, cab drivers, cops numbers 2, 3, sometimes 4, the pilots, the waitresses, and girl at party.
This is You May Have Seen.
Look at this. It's fall, the leaves are changing, the temperature's dropping, pumpkins and everything. Amazing. Just like today's guest. I can't believe I got the chance to sit down with this guy. Mick Betancourt is here. This guy's story, I don't even know what to say. And I'll tell you right now, we barely even scratched the surface. Mick is just an incredible person. He's a badass, for sure. Writer, comedian, actor, producer. We cover as much as we can for one sitting, but there's so much more to him. So, hold on tight, because here we go.
How the hell are you doing?
I'm good.
How you doing?
Given the current state of affairs, you know.
Right?
I think I'm trying to find peace like everybody else, you know.
Today, even just today, like, honestly, it's been kind of an emotional day for me, you know. I mean, yeah. You know, because for anyone who's listening, we're recording this interview the day that the Trumps found out that they tested positive for a coronavirus. And I mean, you know.
For Trump flu. And low-hanging fruit.
See, there you go.
I had to take it.
Exactly. I mean, and while the jokes are all right there, like, honestly, man, I am taking no joy in this whatsoever. None whatsoever. I mean, I feel bad. I do. I don't wish that on anybody.
Yeah.
You know, all the people that have been working for him and working beside him and his wife. I mean, shit.
Even more horrible than the work. I mean.
Right. Right.
I think now is the time
ever and ever
to find your joy, and I think, you know, it, as whatever everything is cyclical, I guess, is that we're coming back to a place where the joy is internal, mm-hmm. and then less about things and acquisitions and
right.
you know, like reconnecting with your neighbors and your family and kind of, I think, your feet gently coming back on the ground after some manic commercialism.
It's really interesting that you say that about coming together with your neighbors, because I'll tell you, like, again, with all the stuff that's been going on, one of the things that I've been thinking about recently is actually sitting down and having, you know, conversations with a conservative, because the, you know, the divisiveness and all the anger and hate that it feels like is built up during this over the years, but so to where it is now at this fever pitch, where I feel like, you know, we don't even look at each other as human beings anymore. So to what you're saying about reconnecting with your neighbors, like, that's just it, is I'm really interested in possibly even sitting down with someone not connected to this industry at all, but somebody who's a conservative, a Republican, whatever, who'd just be willing to have a conversation and talk to each other as humans. Just
sure.
to have, you know, and I don't know if that's doable. It scares the crap out of me to think about it, you know, because I'm not an authority on the subject by any stretch, but it's to be able to connect with people on a personal level and see if that helps progress in any way, you know?
I think that's the only way to get progress. And I think I'm certainly not an authority on that, and most people aren't. And I think the bar where you set, where you either have to feign authority, a place
right.
of authority, you know,
right.
out of some weird, bizarre place of ego, that
right.
you have to be right. But I also think, did you see The Social Dilemma by chance on Netflix?
I haven't. I've heard about it. I've heard good things about it. I'm a little scared to watch it.
Yeah.
I've been told, don't be scared. It's actually a good thing, but I don't know. It gives me a little anxiety to think about watching it. Tell
me
why.
It speaks, I think, to what you just said, where there's kind of a radicalism on both sides, which
yeah.
makes those kind of neighborly conversations impossible just because of what they talk about on the documentary, which is the artificial intelligence and the algorithm of these social media devices in order to, you know, capture and maintain your attention mm-hmm. has pushed you farther and farther in whatever direction you were kind of leaning towards anyway, right. so that the middle disappeared intentionally or not. It's now gone, and most people don't even know that it happened.
Right,
which is the terrifying part.
Right.
Which was it was just you know a money grab for your attention, and it happened, and through kind of the business model, mm-hmm. it was considered successful, but incredibly damaging to civilization.
Yeah, I mean you know, and I feel that that's the only way that we're going to be able to try and progress forward because we have to try and progress forward. I mean, don't we?
Yeah,
we do. So. How do we do it? I mean, you've got to find a way.
If you had
to
guess, it was like, no.
Maybe.
We don't need to dig in.
Right. No, sorry. It is. I'm right and you're wrong. And there's no two ways about it. Next question. So for everybody who's listening, I am just ecstatic to be here with Mick Betancourt, who I'm meeting for the first time. We have a mutual friend in David Palmer. How do you know David?
I know David from just knocking around L.A. And we wound
really?
Up in the same kind of... circle of friends, and I've known him now for about 18 years.
Oh my gosh.
Great guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
He's a great
talented,
guy.
Amazingly talented photographer.
I am and an incredible singer. I mean,
sure,
like
yeah.
I was just shocked to find him, you know, at my house. He was here for a Christmas party last year, and I was like, "You're who?" And so, yeah, we hit it off right away. He's such a great guy, and I was like, "Well, I'm interviewing you. You're coming in and sitting down, and we're going to talk." And then, you know, he's such a great guy. So I'm glad that he connected us. So, Mick is, I got a zillion hyphens in here. Mick is a producer, writer, actor, director, comedian, showgirl, retired samurai. I think he invented the balloon. I don't know.
The samurai balloon.
The samurai.
To be, it's a little known.
But you were a producer and writer on shows like The Deadly Class, The Purge, Shots Fired, which I was honored to be a part of.
Yeah.
I did an episode of that show. Wicked City, Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, Ironside, Necessary Roughness, which I was a big fan of that show, too. I hated to see that go away.
Fun show, yeah.
The Mob Doctor, Breakout Kings, Detroit 187, Law & Order SVU. As an actor, you may have seen Mick in the movie Gangster Squad, opposite Josh Brolin. The TV series The Fugitive and CSI Miami. Man, that's a lot of stuff.
I'm hustling, man.
Welcome. So David warned me ahead of time that you have quite a story to tell.
It's been a life, man.
That's a little bit of an understatement. Oh, I got to say this too. I love that on your IMDb page, your main photo is a picture of the Pope.
Did you read the description?
No.
You got to read the description. This will tell you exactly kind of where I'm at in my career.
It says, Mick as the Pope in the 2015 feature film, Charles Bronson versus Lee Marvin versus the Pope. I missed that one in the theaters. I missed that one.
That was an indie release.
Man.
Just to streamers.
That makeup job is awesome.
Pay-per-view only in Denver, oddly
enough. Very authentic. Very authentic looking, man.
A method.
Oh my God. So I did some research. I watched some videos. I listened to some interviews with you. And to sit there and say, tell me your story. Well, first of all, there's no way that we can cover it in just one sit down.
We could truncate it.
How many times have you told your story, quote unquote?
Well, I did my own podcast. I did that for almost 3 years. And
yeah.
So it was kind of dedicated towards people that had achieved success in various fields,
mm-hmm.
From being a cook to a hairdresser,
right.
to an Oscar,
wow.
Academy Award winners,
yeah.
world champion fighters, you know, but really what were the dark moments where you were going to quit or you quit and
yep.
you came back. Because, you know, talking about the successful stuff is...
Sure.
It's a little hollow for me because it's the Instagram
yeah.
or Snapchat of interviews. I'm really only
right.
seeing everything through the filter to make you look the best.
Yeah, exactly.
As I
sit there and list all your credits, I'm sure, yeah, it makes you sound like, oh my God, this guy's, yeah.
A lunatic.
I learned that too, and
a
I was excited to find that out.
Yeah, so, you know, I've told my story via that podcast,
mm-hmm.
and I pulled it down to relaunch it, and the drive that all the episodes were on crashed.
Oh.
So I lost 157 episodes.
Oh my, because I was looking for it, because it still pops up. It says Mick Betancourt podcast, and I kept finding Mike Betancourt. And I'm like, well, yeah, do you know that there's a Mike Betancourt?
That poor kid. And he worked at Home Depot like I did. And he does stand-up. Like, it's so
Are you serious?
It's like the bizarro, you know, in Superman, there's the bizarro world. Superman. Not to say that I'm Superman, but like there's a bizarro version of me. And I feel so bad because he'll get calls for stand-up gigs still. And like,
oh man.
He's like, should we do a tour? And I'm like, no.
See if they can tell you apart?
I'm like, yeah, man, you got to do your own thing, brother.
So there's no chance of bringing it back. You'd have to just start from zero.
I'm going to probably relaunch it. It's one of the things now, spending a little bit more time away from Los Angeles. So I'm building kind of an art photography podcast kind of studio.
Okay.
And I'm launching a website. And
yep.
So the story of which you speak is kind of going to be the crux of that. And
right.
And going to be doling out on the website, which is going to launch November 1st.
Okay.
Plug in mickbetancourt.com is going to have fiction, art, photography, but then pieces of the memoir are going to come out. So you'll be getting new content.
Gotcha.
Every week.
Because you wrote a book?
I did. So I'm going to release it. I'm going to release most of the chapters first.
Okay.
To help build up the audience that I kind of lost when the podcast went down.
Right.
And then I'll probably put half of the book up, and then hopefully this COVID thing will have passed.
Mm-hmm.
I just started to tour, oddly enough, the book where I had done an hour of some of the stories in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that in Seattle, San Francisco, Chicago, and New York.
Wow.
So I'm looking to kind of build that audience back up online.
Yep.
Then do 100-seat theaters in like 12 to 18 months.
Sure.
Do 10 100-seat theaters.
Nice.
And then, you know, my three-year goal is to build it up to like a 300 to 500-seat theater.
Man, I think that will be a really great... I say intimate just because like playing those smaller venues like mm-hmm. that where people can really feel like they're connecting with you. I think that's, especially again, the little bit that I've learned, again, I'm sure that there's so much more, but to feel like you kind of have that living room setting with an audience. Yeah. That'll be really, really exciting.
I actually, you know, if I could, I would rather do double the dates at the 100-seat theater.
Right.
Then, you know, that's more of an economic thing of the travel, the hotel, everything you got to do to put yourself up. So if you're an artist listening now
mm-hmm.
and you're waiting for some gatekeeper to kind of, real or imagine, give you permission to go do something,
right,
just fucking go do it.
Like, yeah,
there is no that idea of the right part coming in,
right,
the right script, meeting the right person,
right,
like generate that opportunity on your own by a ferocious
right
amount of work contrary to how you feel, right? So you should, at least for me, I still am like, am I a writer? Like, you know, it's just like, well, I've been doing this for 20 years, like, so I have to coexist with those conflicting, all artists do most mm-hmm. I've only met a real handful that are just so intrinsically confident.
Yep.
Two, maybe, one writer and one actor. They're just like, this is what I do. I'm totally comfortable with this. And oddly, there's an odd sense of humility in it. They're not cocky and it's not egotistical.
Yep.
It's just, I feel very confident in my capacity to do this.
Yeah.
But I just encourage everybody listening, even if you are going to shut off later when I start telling my story, like, just do you, you know, lean into what speaks to your soul.
Right.
And just be ambitious and elated every time you get to play in the sandbox and experience that art, whatever your art is.
For those of us who are out there who are just really just humping it, how did this happen for you?
I mean, I can answer that generally, but is there any like particular piece that you would that you would say, this is successful? Because for me, I feel like getting to experience anything for me is, I consider a success.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just worked a day on The Fugitive, right? And I got mm-hmm. to play a police officer and
right.
it was great. I
yeah.
got to act.
Yep.
So for me, that's a big success, you know? Shout out to Chris Fields in Los Angeles, great artistic director of the Echo Theater. I was taking classes with him,
mm-hmm.
and we were doing small class, 12 people on the planks, you know, doing monologues and scenes.
Yep.
Success.
Sure.
Success. So I think success is subjective. If that makes sense.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah.
I think that, again, for the people that I am primarily affiliated with, they are the ones who are trying to find a way to make a living in this business,
gotcha.
Who are trying
to
get paid to work in this business.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are certainly a fair number who just want to have their, you know, creative spirit filled. But I know that a lot of the ones who listen are trying to break in and, you know, be part of the actual job,
mm-hmm.
you know, to get paid to do it.
Sure.
Yeah. Coming from where you came from.
Yeah.
How did you end up breaking into, and how did you end up choosing this business, this industry?
I was really poor, and I think it's important because it informs my sense of self and it mm-hmm. informs all my creativity and the well that I go to as a writer, as an actor, a director, a painter, a photographer.
Right.
It just, it's my point of view, right? I saw Richard, first I saw Jackie Gleason in The Honeymooners, And I was like, he's screaming, they're broke, they don't have any money. And I was like, we were broke, we didn't have any money. Mm-hmm. There was a...
You keep talking, I'm going to wipe up the water I just spilled.
Oh my God.
So you saw Jackie Gleason, and they were yelling and screaming at each other.
Yeah, and it just seemed like... I didn't know that you could talk about that because I grew up in a home where, you know, there was a bizarre sense of pride in the dysfunction, you know, just didn't want to put anything out there that anything right. bad was happening. And that's what the whole show was about.
Yep.
And not only was it wasn't a sad therapy session, it was hilarious. I couldn't believe it. So that was one thing. And then I didn't really know what stand-up was, and mm-hmm. I saw Richard Pryor.
Oh.
And I was like, what? He's talking about heroin addiction. There were heroin addicts in my house and violence and I couldn't believe that. And then there was no one else around.
Right.
He was just on a stage by himself and talking into a microphone. I couldn't believe it.
Yep.
So there were these little formative moments. And then one time, yeah, I was watching like PBS and Macbeth was on.
Wow.
And I was a kid and I was like, what is this? And it just seemed clunky and verbose and difficult mm-hmm. and stodgy, but
right.
There was something weird about it, but the cadence of the words were interesting, and I'm just like perplexed by this, and I'm like in my pajamas, and my uncle comes up behind me with the book, and he points and he found where they were at in the play,
right?
And then he's showing me the words.
Oh my God.
And I was like, it just blew my mind that there were cameras and that this was acting.
Damn.
And someone had written it.
Yep.
And then there were lights and like people had to show up and who gave them their clothes.
Yep.
Like it just blew my mind.
Wow.
It was a whole weird, it like burst the juvenile entertainment bubble.
Yeah.
So there were just these weird kind of moments. And then I would go to the library as a bit of a safe haven. And I would just look at these great books.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would write the first sentence of a great book in hand, in mm-hmm. like handwriting. And I was like, this may sound bizarre, but for me, I was like, you know, I can't dunk like Michael Jordan because I'm from Chicago originally, right? So like, yes. and I can't paint like the Mona Lisa,
mm-hmm.
but I just wrote the first sentence of The Great Gatsby with my hand.
Right.
They were the exact same letters.
Right.
And I viewed it like 24 letters or like notes. And so this person are playing these notes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have access to 24 letters. They have access to 24 letters. Mm-hmm. Like, what can I do with that? So I started writing was the first thing that I did. I
yep.
would write. My friend, Mike Cohn, and I would do comic books.
Mm-hmm.
We would both kind of try to draw. He would draw most of it, and I would write, and we would do photocopy papers, and we would incorporate people from the school in the stories to try. We'd sell them for a quarter a piece.
Yep.
And people would buy them because they'd want to see what they were up to that week.
Oh,
like,
my gosh.
We were just,
oh, my God.
We were just hustling. We were broke, you know? So
yep.
it was just stuff like that. So that was just me experiencing art and
right.
creativity. That wasn't, so that's like, it's formulating in my brain. I was going to go into the Marines. I got a last minute scholarship to college. I got punted out of college and I just started. I was a short order cook, a mall mm-hmm. security guard. I'm getting the carts at Dominick's. I turned 21. I was a bag boy at Dominick's, which is like a grocery store in Chicago.
Yep.
It just, not a lot of hope. And stand-up was dead. The 80s boom had burst. This is like...
Okay.
93, 94.
Yeah.
And so, but I love stand-up, and I just started looking in the paper, like, where are the open mics?
Mm-hmm.
What is an open mic? Where can
right.
I go see comedy? There
right.
was one comedy club that was left open, but there was no scene. It was just starting. There was a scene. There was like two open mics.
Yep.
So I just started going there and signing up and trying to do stand-up, what I thought was stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately I didn't like not being in control of my own destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just looked, and it wasn't a comedy club. And then when I got to know the people, they just went to that bar and asked if they could do the stage and the whole thing.
Yep.
And I thought, well, I can do that. So I just started going to different venues and saying, can I do comedy here on Tuesday? Can I just didn't want to wait for someone else
sure.
to decide when my break was.
Right.
So I just started hustling right away.
Yeah.
And it started through stand-up. I did the first time I got paid to do stand-up, I co-featured. So there's a host. Traditionally
yep.
in comedy clubs, there's a host that does 15. The feature usually does 30.
Yep.
The headliner does 45. Sometimes you do a co-feature.
Yep.
So the co-feature is 15 each. Was it Zany's Mount Prospect, which was mm-hmm. in a Red Lobster that had been converted into
sure.
a
yep.
comedy club. And then
yep.
a week later, it closed. So I was coming into that boom. And Zany's, you know, as a business was booking traditionally more well-known, established comedians. It wasn't necessarily a talent incubator
yep.
because they needed to pay their bills. But, you know, as a young artist, you're like, you need to do the edgy thing. Well, that's their business. So we decided there was just so many great comedians that came out of that scene that just started their own, I guess it's called the alternative scene because it would just be an alternative venues. Yep. But like the Lincoln Lodge, Mark Geary still putting on shows in Chicago right now. And is just a pillar in the independent comedy community. Started at the Red Lion. There was the Lion's Den, which was an open mic on Mondays, where Kumail Nanjiani came out, Kyle Kinane, Pete Holmes, Mike Holmes, Mike Bridenstine, Matt Bronger, Beth Stelling, Brady Novak, T.J. Miller. Like, crazy. Like, someone recently posted 70 people would sign up.
Whoa,
and like the
yeah.
names that were in there were just,
I'm sure.
And I apologize if I left anybody else off. John Roy, Dwayne Kennedy. I mean, just insane.
How long did you stand up for?
This is the first year that I went the whole year without doing stand up.
Really?
So I never stopped. Yeah, and I had a, which is so great that there's a squeaky toy going off while there's a comedy. While we're discussing comedy, I bring my own squeaky toy. Yeah, by the way, it seems difficult for the people listening.
It breaks the tension.
Seems like an obstacle and an intrusion, but actually, it becomes my thing now. It's my hook. It's like Newhart stutter.
But between working on the TV shows, and which is a huge time commitment, especially doing writing and producing like you were doing, where did stand up fit into all that?
Well, it was when. Well, if I was out of town doing stand-up, I'd be away from, or working on a TV show per se, I'd be away from the family. So the nights, you know, if I'm scouting, then that's a semi-reasonable day. It's from like 8 in the morning till 7 at night.
Yep.
And if I don't have anything to do for the show the next day, I would just go by whatever the club was and do a guest set.
Okay.
So if I, you know, was working on Law & Order SVU, Caroline's would let me go up, or New York Comedy Club was pretty cool and let me go up. So, you know, I would just get it in to keep those chops tight, you know?
When did you sleep?
I didn't really. I don't travel well. And by the way, I've made maybe in my entire comedy career, I mean, I've done stand-up on Comedy Central, NBC, HBO, and like one other, and I think
because I looked for stand-up stuff on you and I couldn't find anything.
I know, it's
crazy. Says comedian, but I couldn't find. I was like, there's got to be clips,
which is weird. They you know, I'm surprised. There has to be at least 4 to 8 people that have watched my Comedy Central set. It's very disheartening that Comedy Central took it down. Or my 2007 Late Friday set.
What do you think the world of stand-up is like? Where are they now? What's the hope? What's the outlook?
Well, they're doing Zoom shows. They're doing social distance shows, and I feel like, you know, the kingdom always needs a jester. So it's and there's just so many shades of comedy too. You know, there's wackadoodle, goofy, fatty fall down. Mm-hmm. Then there's, you know, I'm so cool, I'm trying to not be funny to be funny. I mean, there's all different shades of that.
Yep.
And I think it will always, especially now where, you know, you just do your thing, put your stuff on TikTok, put your stuff on Instagram. You know, you have to be, you don't have to do anything, but there in a world, there are opportunities for those who are ambitious.
Yep.
Some people just want to be artists, and that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And then that requires on somebody else deciding, you know, when you use the word success. The reason why I said that is, and started to say, you know, how much I've made in stand-up is like, I would never be able to survive on the money that I made for stand-up.
Oh, no.
But I never wanted to deny myself the joy of doing it. So my success, if I just go to Comedy Zone and I go to the manager who's not going to know me and say, you know, how many nights do I have to come hang till I get to do a guest set?
Right.
Even if it's just 6 minutes. I consider that a success if I can go to a strange new town and do stand-up. For me, I just started peaking as a comedian or whatever you want, not peaking, but just becoming, you know, in that ecosystem and could have popped. And I had a moment of clarity of like, oh, this will kill me. This is not for me. Like, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do it.
Right.
Or that it's healthy for you.
I tried to go back to it a couple of years ago just to see. For the same reason. It was like, okay, I walked away from it because, I don't want to say I stumbled into acting, but I mean, I never thought pursuing acting was an option for me. I'm from Rhode Island, you know, smallest state in the country. My parents are working class people. They didn't know how to be supportive and be like, oh, you can be an actor. They're like, no, that doesn't happen here.
You tell your dad and you think he's going to be angry, but instead he's like, let's just do some Meisner repetition. Yeah. Let's do some movement. You're like, how do you even... He takes you in a secret part of the garage,
right,
which is a statue of Stanislavski, and you're like, "Dad,
you sell oil filters? What? I never knew." To go into stand-up was a huge transition because, again, I shocked them when I said I could do that. But just like you were like, if I, you know, hustle enough or if I stand in line long enough, I can get on stage at a comedy club. Okay, yeah. I can do that. To get into acting was something even bigger and more absurd, but somehow it happened here. So when I realized, oh, I can go that way, and there weren't a lot of stand-up opportunities here in Charlotte at the time, so I walked away from that. But, you know, I did okay when I did it. You know, just like everybody else, I had good nights, I had shitty nights, I had really good nights. So it's like, I know it's a skill that I've got. I don't know, a couple of years ago, I was like, I would regret if I didn't see what it would be like to try and do it now, you know, much older, twice a lifetime. And similarly, I was like, okay, what am I going to consider success? And I bombed horribly right from the get-go. But then, you know, a couple tries later, it's like, you know, blew the roof off the place. And it was like, okay. I didn't have the same feeling that I did when I was in my 20s, when, you know, that same rush. And that was a big indicator for me where I was like, nah, you got to love it. You've got to love that grind. You've got to love waiting until 1 o'clock in the morning to go on stage or to try and go from Chinese restaurant to comedy club to somebody's basement to hit as many mics as you can get. And sure. I was just like, that's not for me.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you realize that. I had a similar realization where what I wanted to do wasn't really comedy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There, say 60% of it was.
Yep.
But the log line for my podcast was half comedy, half drama, all heart. So that really evolved to from stand-up to storytelling.
Yep.
And I looked at like what David Sedaris was doing or what The Moth does.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what if I just did an hour of stories? And so that's what I started touring. And it wasn't a one-person show. It was just an hour of storytelling. And so, but it had combined moments of what would, you know, would seem jokey, but all embedded in
mm-hmm.
a narrative, which didn't have the kind of every 30 to 60 second punchline requirements a traditional stand-up set.
Right.
And I didn't feel bad moving past that. I had an amazing, the relationships are phenomenal, and it is such a, it's an unforgiving art form. You know, if they laugh, it's working. If they don't, it is not.
Right.
There's really no middle ground.
No, absolutely.
Or it's not comedy.
When I did it back in the early 90s, and was working, you know, in Providence and Boston and in that area, and still when I was in college, because I went to school down here. Of course, the characters that you run across, you know, the other comedians, they're still there. I wasn't as interested in, you know, really being a part of that anymore. Like when I first started doing it, there was a guy who, he and his buddy killed somebody with a tree branch. And he was up on stage doing stand-up, and at the same time, he was waiting to, you know, be arraigned. Yeah, he was living in a rectory with, you know, with some priest to show that he had a cleaned up image and that he was just, it wasn't me, it was my friend. But yeah, they killed a guy with a tree limb. Yep. I was like, all right, this is
my curse, by the way, of recording mm-hmm. anything.
Yeah.
Once you mention comedy, like yeah. I recorded 3 comedy albums,
mm-hmm.
2 times the DAT just stopped working.
Yep.
So I never got it. And then the other time there was a problem with the mic connection. And then the second we started talking about comedy, like squishy toy, dog barking, guy mowing the lawn. Like the comedy gods are just like, we would like to take a heaping hot shit on your chest. Is that cool and not in a pleasant?
I'm not even joking. I have not had this many sound disruptions in an interview in the 2+ years that I've been doing this. With your comedy background, your almost your entire body of work is drama. Have you tried to venture into writing comedy for television or for film?
Yeah, so I just finished a half-hour spec, which is really more of again, kind of my tone of comedy, mm-hmm. and almost a nice transition from the hour of stories that I was doing,
right.
which have a dramatic kind of undercurrent, but are ultimately funny if you did the ratio out. So it's more of a kind of where the half hour is evolving right now. The hours are getting shorter. Mm-hmm. Half hours are getting less jokey.
Right.
So the feet are kind of coming back down to the ground for kind of grounded human stories and comedy. Because comedy for a while was, you suck, no, you suck, laugh track. And I think now we're getting, the characters are breathing a little bit more. They're alive a little more. So this is my kind of first attempt to really, I wrote one other half hour spec and this is my second one now.
Now, out of this list of shows that I went through where you were producer, writer, Deadly Class, The Purge, Shots Fired, Wicked City, Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, Ironside, Necessary Roughness, The Mob Doctor, Breakout Kings, Detroit 187, Law and Order, I already know the answer to that, Law and Order SVU.
And the Black Donnellys, which might not be on there.
Oh, it wasn't on there, no. Yeah. Are any of those shows your baby, your idea, did you originally create any of those?
No, I was staffed on all of those. Okay. I've sold 5 shows, none of which have made it to air. So I don't think IMDb will show an IMDb Pro things that you have in development. But then once those kind of phase out of development, they either get shot and you know, become pilots, and then sometimes they decide whether they're going to order the pilot to series or not. But now with premium streamers like Amazon and Netflix, they just order series. They order right to series, sometimes off the pitch. So I've got some things in development now that I'm excited about. 3 shows in development, actually, right now. So hopefully one of those will go.
Right. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk more about you and the things that you've encountered in your life. More with Mick Betancourt in just a minute. You are listening to You May Have Seen, proud member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. There are so many great podcasts on the network showcasing great stories by great people and shining a spotlight on the Queen City. You can find them all at queencitypodcastnetwork.com. I want to take a minute to share some info on a volunteer organization here in town that I'm a big fan of, called Leah's Hopes and Dreams. And I don't think it comes as a surprise to anyone to hear that the homeless population has increased exponentially and continues to grow during this time of COVID-19. Colder temperatures are coming. It's going to hit. The rent relief programs are coming to an end as of December 31st. And Leah's Hopes and Dreams, they've already done a lot of amazing work. Their most recent campaign is to raise $100,000 towards building a tiny home community. They've already built a home for a homeless family and are in the process of renovating a building for a new men's shelter. This is something that you might not be familiar with. Approximately 4,770 children in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system report being homeless at some point throughout the academic year. Homeless families cannot stay together in the shelters, and landlords can start evicting again, so the homeless population is expected to rise. So if you're listening and you don't live in the Charlotte area and you want to get involved and help support similar programs, I'm sure that you can probably find one in wherever you are, because I'm sure that this problem is not special to the Charlotte, North Carolina area. So if you do want to help these folks out, you can go to their website, leahshopesanddreams.org. There are several ways to donate. You can text LHD to 44321. You can PayPal them at Leah's Hopes and Dreams. They take donations through the Cash App. You can send them a check. You can find them on Facebook and all over social media to try and find out how to best support them. So I think it's a really wonderful thing if anybody wants to get involved in that and help them out, because I think we can all agree homelessness is bad. We probably need to do some work to help these folks out. So, yeah. All right. So, again, we are talking with Mick Betancourt. During this time, during the pandemic and the shutdown and everything, have you been writing more? Have you been trying to take advantage of this time? Because you tell me what you think about it. I was thinking that once this is over and we kind of get the green light, or the studios figure out how to get back to work, I feel like programming is going to just take off like crazy. Agree, disagree?
You hope so. Yeah. I think it was difficult, I think, for everybody, myself included, to remain consistently ambitious and take big swings given all of the adjustments that people had to make.
Right.
But I think that being said, I think there's, you know, I wrote, when I say, I guess created is the right word, but it's not out in the ecosphere, but it's speaking to what you're saying, that there's content on deck ready to go into the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a feature, a 1-hour drama, a 1/2-hour drama. I'm writing another 1-hour drama. And then I'm writing a short story every week to try to build content for the website.
Right.
and the memoir as well. So okay. I'm just trying to do what I can, you know, like keep creating, keep mm-hmm. creating despite how I feel.
To right.
just, that's what I do. That's who right. I am. It's what I do for a living. And I have to honor it, you know.
Is there a COVID script in there? Did you go that
no,
route?
No, I won't.
Good.
And I even thought good. About it. And I was like, not writing one, but having people. Right. And I was just like, you know what? No, I'm not going to.
Yeah.
I'm not.
No, I'm going to be interested to see how many people do go down that road and who's going to be, you know, the bold network to go, let's put it out there.
Oh, the COVID shows have already been ordered. I've seen.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You're just.
Oh, my God. All right. So let's get into it if we can. All right. So I did some research on you, found a little bit of stuff. I'm just going to throw some things out and you decide which way you want to go.
Okay.
So you panhandled and you stole food.
Yes.
I heard a story about a Wheaties mayo sandwich.
Oh, yeah. Stale now. You're bringing me back.
I watched the video that you did for Fenwick Academy.
Yeah, Fenwick High
is,
School.
Yeah, where you went to high school. Is in Chicago or just on the outskirts of Chicago?
It's on the border in a neighborhood called Oak Park.
Okay. It was a really great little video to kind of get an introduction to you. I do have to say that I think my favorite part, though, of the video are the two kids sitting next to you who are just doing this the whole time.
Oh, the priests?
No, there were two of the students. There was one girl who just could have given a shit that you were sitting next to her and that she was even on camera. Like, she could have given a shit. And then there was a skinny blonde kid who was just kind of doing this.
Oh, so funny.
The whole time.
Yeah, that's a rough age.
It is. A poor, they didn't
almost,
know.
When I was 18, I was so stupid. I almost joined the Marines twice to get a sword. Like, it's like they're giving out swords? What?
And I have to do what?
4 years of my life for a sword? That sounds like a fucking great deal.
Does it?
That's amazing. I get to kill dragons? I saw the commercial.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I remember that commercial for the
movie. You know how insane you have to be like, this will get him in. Like, if you have any sense, if you're not in that weird testosterone teenage vortex of your life,
right?
Any normal adult's like, wait, why did I go in the Marines? A fucking dragon. Like, what?
Wait, wow, this friggin' bottle of water is determined. Clearly, I am not thirsty. Holy balls! Oh my God! You gotta be kidding me! I really want to thank you for coming.
Yeah. We did comedy twice in the comedy gods.
See, I'm going to keep talking in the background. I'm cleaning up water that I spilled twice now in the last 40 minutes.
This is when I found out that Ryan spent 20 years in the Marines and just threw his water bottle through the window as I slandered the core.
That's why he got thrown out. Like, I keep spilling water, man. We can't give him a weapon. He can't handle a sword. Yeah.
I just look at myself in the Marines now, like, you got to get him young, because I'd be like, why are you yelling? Like, what, the monkey bars? I got to swing on the monkey bars? Can we wake up at 10?
Yeah, really.
Have you tried talking to the enemy? Have you sent him an email?
If I promise to get my work done, can I sleep?
There's a thing in Chicago called Frango Mints. Can we send North Korea some Frango Mints?
All right. Continuing with just some buzzwords for you. You know, and I don't. You let me know if I've gone too far, but you put it out there, and I found it. Two words, Vinny Valero.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, what a great name. What a great friggin' name. You got to make him a character at some point.
That's in the script I'm writing now.
Well,
I can speak to any of these. Whenever you tell me, you guide the interview, I'll jump in. I can tell whatever story.
Go back to the beginning. I mean, you know, I know that's way back, but I mean, you had a very unstable upbringing, to say the least.
Yeah, I think alcoholism, drug addiction, mental health issues just wreaked havoc on my family. My parents were 16 and 17 when I was born. My dad got custody of me almost right away. And we lived in a illegally converted kind of house in the two apartments. And we shared the house with a black family that lived upstairs. They had three kids, Tyrone, Dude, and Bebe. Nice. And it was a Puerto Rican neighborhood called Humble Park in Chicago.
Okay.
And my dad's Puerto Rican. So, but I was like Steve Martin in The Jerk, like, because I didn't speak, because I came out so white that in Chicago is a pretty racist city. They're uh-huh. like, just don't teach him fucking Puerto Rican. Like, he's going to pass. Like, just let him be. And because when my dad got custody of me, my mom's father, like, disowned her for okay. being a teen mom
yeah.
And hooking up with a Puerto Rican guy. And so I just hung out with the three black kids. And, like, I just thought I was black till I was seven. I was like, what? I'm not black? Like, what, for real? Mama? Like, it was just crazy. And then when my dad died, I went to go move in with my mom. And she's like, I'm going to beat the black out of you. Like, anytime I, because I had this kind of flair, because I right. just mimicked the colloquialisms
right.
and inflections of the mm-hmm. kids that I hung out with. And I just got cracked, man. And it was just a weird, weird time. She was an alcoholic. She would take me drinking with her. So I would just be like, I remember one night, the first time we went out drinking, I was dead asleep. And she's like, get up, we're going out. And I'm like, what? Nah, I lived with her. She had, it was between a studio and a one-bedroom apartment.
Right.
And her dad, my grandfather, owned mm-hmm. the building. So it was like a two apartment deal.
Right.
But her apartment was cut in half because he converted it to this Polish beauty salon. So like, you would just hear those big yep. domes
yes.
that go over
yes.
the old ladies' heads
yes.
in the morning. They're screaming, screaming in Polish over the things that are over their ears.
Right.
And that weird perm scent coming in through the walls. But she's like, get up, we're going out. And I'm like, what? We're going out. She's like, we're going dancing. Wear something sexy. I was like, nine. I'm like, sexy?
So you broke out the Spider-Man pajamas.
I rocked the corduroy pants that I had from the stocky section at Sears.
Sure. Sure.
As you do
yep.
when you're serious about clubbing. And my mustard yellow Catholic schoolboy shirt from the school that I was going to called St. Odilo. And if you're unfamiliar with St. Odilo, as 99%
yep.
of even all Catholics are,
yep.
St. Odilo is the patron saint of purgatory, which means the patron saint of being average. You're just like the patron saint of meh.
So, I wonder how Odilo felt about that when they're like, we'll make you saint of this. I haven't yeah. done anything.
How are exactly. these kids? Meh. These kids got a future. Meh. Oh my God. So,
wow.
Yeah, so I wore that to the club.
How'd you do that night? In that getup.
You know, I don't kiss and tell, Brian. But I went in, and just imagine, the name of the place that she took me to that night was called Tootie Toots, which was a kind of a outfit, which is a... It was just like Italian guys with low cut things.
Oh my God.
Chicago outfits like the Mafia in New York or everywhere mm-hmm. else. And so they're, you know, playing. I remember they were playing Lookout Weekend by Debbie Deb, and there was a smoke machine, and my mom's dancing by the mirrors. And she's like, go get some drinks, you know, get us a couple Manhattans. So I go to the bar, like, I'm clearly
yeah.
nine. It's like midnight or one in the morning. Yeah. And, you know, I order two Manhattans. I don't know the man. And the guy, you know, takes all the dough, shakes the kid, you know, no change because he knows I'm not. I don't
sure.
understand what change is. Even when I bring the drinks back, my mom goes, where's the change? Like, what did you give me? He goes, fucking jag off. Like, you know, she
right.
knew.
Right.
It was all so messed up. And he's like, keep your mind checked tonight, kid. Like I'm the wow. adult. I'm nine.
Right.
And I drank the Manhattan, and it was like drinking gasoline. I mean, I still couldn't drink a Manhattan now. But... was drinking, dancing, you know, and then I go to school the next day, and the nun's like, we're learning fractions. And I was like, I got home an hour ago. Like, fractions.
Whoa.
What are you talking about?
What?
Yeah.
And that was your kind of basic existence.
Well, yeah, we would go out a lot, and sometimes I would drive home. Sometimes she'd pick a guy up. I'd drive them home, you know, between 9 and like around... like 9 and 10, and then my grandfather
uh-huh.
warmed up to me. He when I first moved in, he'd say, how's the kid doing, to my mom, and
right.
I'd be standing right now. I was like, who's the kid? I like kids.
Yeah.
Like, but he didn't possess.
Right.
But, you know, his alcoholism really did some damage on the family, and I think he was sober when I met him.
Yeah.
and he was trying to do right by letting her live downstairs, and now she had custody of the kid again. But, you know, there'd be times that I wouldn't eat because she'd be too drunk, or there just wouldn't be any money.
Yeah.
And the fridge would be empty, so I would go up and steal his stuff that was on his ledge, like generic chips from Aldi's. I don't know if you remember. So, like, the bottle would just say grape soda.
Yes.
That's it.
Drink.
Fruit drink. It's like a syrupy, acidic sugar bomb.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so I would go up, and he caught me one time, and he said, hey, come on in. Black Stallion's on. You ever seen Black Stallion? And I said, no. And he goes, it's got Mickey Rooney. It's going to be good. So I walk in, and, you know, here was a guy who came over from, I think he's Irish, but he was born in Scotland, came over when he was 13. Mm-hmm. All his older brothers had worked in the coal mines. And hazed the shit out of him because he did.
Sure.
Came over, and then the Great Depression hit. Then he went into the war. And he was an alcoholic. And he was divorced. And his kids loved him and hated him at the same time.
Right.
His daughter lived downstairs. He had a son who was in Mensa, which I didn't know what that was. But, you know, you got your smarty pants on when you're in Mensa.
Yeah.
So, but he was an alcoholic and got diagnosed with MS in his mid-20s. Hated his dad, but had nowhere else to go.
Jesus.
So he walled off the living room of his apartment to let Tommy live in that room. And they shared a bathroom. But Tommy hated him. Wouldn't even talk to him. But it was a way for him to kind of make amends to his son.
Right.
And so here I was, probably this unexpected opportunity maybe to set things right with somebody.
Yep.
So, and I don't think either of us even recognized it in that moment, but I went in, and so really where he lived was the kitchen, which had a steel table in the middle of it, and then kind of like a bar with a TV on it, and two tattered Lazy Boy recliners, which faced the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And then a room for him to sleep, and then kind of like a little sunroom. I went in, I sat down, I got to eat, he made popcorn. And, you know, this movie was about this old guy who comes across this young kid.
Mm-hmm.
And the old guy's life was broken and lonely and feeling a little hopeless. And then this kid rolls around and they both kind of realize that they can kind of help each other out. And at the end of the movie, you know, I'm crying and he's crying. And he says, you know, why don't you stay up here tonight? And I said, well, you know, at this point, also, which I had left out, is my mom was extremely physically violent. So I'm like, you know, I'm getting the shit kicked out of me all the time.
Right.
So I'm like, I can't deal with, you know, I'm going to catch a beating if I stay up there. And he's like, I'll deal with her. So it was from that point on that I just started staying up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would eat this magical thing called breakfast. Right. If you haven't tried
it. I think it's going to catch on. I think it might catch on.
It happens mostly in the morning. Sometimes it's hot.
Sometimes it's hot. Right.
And it was amazing. Like I'd eat oatmeal.
Yeah.
And, you know, a couple days in a row. I mean, it was just like, you know, but to me, those things were not, since I was born, it wasn't steady, you know. So there was a steadiness in that that was outstanding. And I just, you know, and then I would live with my grandmother on the weekends still, you know. And then when I was 13, my grandfather died. He had a heart attack in my arms in that apartment.
Yeah.
And, man, that just wrecked me to my core. I couldn't save him. I jumped down the stairs and leapt over the balcony and banging on my mom's door. And I said, Gramps dead, Gramps dead, Gramps dead. She opens the door. I'm like, what? She's drunk. She'd been up almost the whole night. And then her kitchen was like Gramps' kitchen. She had a dining room table in the kitchen.
Yep.
And there was a naked dude on the table with a bottle of vodka, like his dick just kind of hanging over his thigh. And he's like, huh? And I'm screaming, Gramps dead. Like, right now, I imagine that guy is at some bar, you know, where they're like, Frankie, tell the story of the time you were banging that crazy Irish broad and the door's banging and her kid's there and her dad's dead. You got to tell that one. No one's going to believe it.
Right.
Perspectives, man. Like,
how are you not in a constant fetal position somewhere in a corner?
So it gets even better, Brian.
I'm sure it does.
It gets better. So he's Gramps gone. I wind up staying in his apartment, really.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom's sinking lower and lower into her mental health issues.
Right.
And so no one kind of claimed me.
Yep.
So that was June of my seventh grade summer. So I went through all of that summer, all of eighth grade summer. I'd see my mom every now and then. But there was no food, which was where you're, you know, so I ate all the food that Gramp had. So I went through the cupboards.
Right.
That seventh grade summer, I lived on a box of rice that he had, like a big box of rice. And then he had some canned foods. And, you know, as a kid, you start going through the fruit cocktail. Like, yep. This is good shit.
Yep.
And then when you get to the fucking green, you know, just like, oh, you're just choking it down. Because you're like, I got to eat something, you know. Right. And then the mice showed up. Like, you know, it was bad. And so the mice would eat through the bread. And then I'd use the parts that they didn't eat to make... You know, I'm just trying to figure out what to eat. And I had mayonnaise.
Yep.
I had some Wheaties left and I had the fucking bread. So I'm like, let's see how this works out. And so I'm eating this sandwich, right? And I should tell you that Tommy had a freezer on my side of the apartment.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Because it was a living room. So he had like a little dorm fridge in there and then he kept this big thing. I never stole from him because you don't steal from your family. That's a fucking scumbag move.
Right.
So... Which I should say, I knew Grandpa had a safe, you know, in our apartment.
Okay.
And the key was, because he used to make me climb up the shelves to get the key to the safe. No one was rich. It was just a safe. You know what I mean? He dies.
Yep.
We all go to the hospital. I come back. The fucking safe is open. So scumbag Tommy comes in and all of a sudden his MS is cured enough for the day where he can fucking scurry up that fucking shelf mountain and get the key like a genuine piece of shit and get into the safe like some shitty Michael Mann movie where the thief has a cane.
Wow.
And so I'm eating this sandwich.
Uh-huh.
And Tommy comes out and he goes, did you steal my steaks? I'm eating bread that has mouse holes in it with crunchy, stale Wheaties.
Yep.
And mayonnaise. And I'm like, what did you just say? And he goes, did you eat my fucking steaks? And I go, oh, yeah. And I just figured after that, I would have this, you fucking sack of shit.
You know what? I'm going to say in defense of Tommy, you're a smart guy. If you're going to take his steaks, you're not going to have them right in front of him.
Yeah.
That's a great cover.
Yeah.
It's a great cover.
Yeah.
I would have fucking accused you of taking the steaks, too.
This is a mayonnaise-covered filet. Tommy, I think because I heard you creeping in towards my side.
Yeah, the steaks are under the mattress. No, you take those out after he goes to sleep.
Here's the best part. Tommy dies. Yeah, what you say? Is that the best part? You bet your fucking ass it is.
Oh, Jesus.
So years later, he dies.
Right.
He had a pal named Bernie that worked down the street. He was embarrassed to come out during the day, so he'd go out at night. At the convenience store down at the end of the block, he wound up befriending the counter lady named her name was Bernice, but we all called her Bernie.
Okay.
So Tommy dies. No one's really talking to Tommy. Tommy dies. Bernie calls my other uncle. Hey, come help me clean out Tommy's place. Now, we're later in my life. I've moved out of that place.
Okay.
Tommy had to move out because they were trying to sell the building, but it was infested with rodents.
Jesus.
And it was just not well. Like, you couldn't give the place. No one was like, ooh, that's... does it come with the mice? Or is that extra?
How many? Nobody. I only want some of them.
Yeah. I don't have 1,000 little tiny adorable cages. So this is years later. Mother uncle calls me because you're not going to believe this. And I go, really? Are we at that stage? How bizarre has our lives been so far? Please don't tee it up that way because of course it's going to be insane. Like there's no... God. So Tommy dies. He goes over there to help Bernie clean his apartment out. And it's all high-end leather paddles, handcuffs. He was a S&M dominatrix guy.
Sure.
I don't know if that's gender specific for the male version of that.
Right.
He was the male version of a dominant guy
that
smacks the shit out of you.
Oh my God.
For wealthy older women in this suburb that weren't intimidated by him because of his MS. And they figured they could get away if they had to because he had MS. I was like, of course, this motherfucker.
How bad could it be? He's got a mess.
Yes. Did those old ladies steal his steaks?
Come over with your paddle. Guy, bring your paddle over.
Every time you hit him, did you steal my steaks? Did you steal my steaks? It was like a thing he had. It was like his S&M catchphrase.
Wow. You end up living...
Well, so I was there, and then the food ran out, and then, you know, I tried to look for work. I think it was 13 or 14, and I got a job as a caddy.
I caddied for years.
They called me the menstrual caddy because I only showed up 1 week a month. That was my nickname. And then I get so hungry because I wasn't eating.
Yep.
I do a loop and I get like $10
yeah.
in the scumbag gas station right next to the gas
yep.
to the court, yep. which charged like $4 for a Snickers bar because they knew all the kids were finishing sure. their loops and had cash.
Fuck.
So I take all the money I made and I bought shitty junk food. Yep. I go home, no money.
Right.
I went, there was a Tasty Freeze down the block for me, and I would go to the guy, hey, you know, I'll do anything for a burger and fries and a sandwich. And
right.
he you know, felt bad for me. So go clean the parking lot. So I go clean the parking lot. He'd give me a burger, fries, mm-hmm. and shit. And then I went, and I'm like, hey, can I do it? He's like, parking lot's clean, man. Sorry, I can't help you. Yeah. So I started dumping the trash in yep. the parking lot to create the problem and sell the solution, like pharma, big pharma. So...
You're an innovator.
And then he caught me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then this is where like, it's a weird, there's an odd sense of shame that comes when you're really poor because you're trying to make moves.
Right.
And then that, you know, the look that people give you is just, it just cuts right to your core. So he's like, you know, I was trying to fucking help you and mm-hmm. you're a scumbag. And I'm like, fuck. So I started panhandling. Like, hey, I remember my grandfather told me when he had panhandled during the Depression, they used to say, hey, brother, can you spare a dime? So I was just like, hey, can you get money? Whatever. And I just, I didn't have the right words for it. And people would laugh thinking, oh, this isn't real. Or they get look at me like a scumbag, tell me to get a job.
Yeah.
And then I just started seeing older people. So, hey, brother, can you spare a dime? I'm down on my luck. I try to use the same,
right.
you know,
right.
phraseology that he had taught me. And, oh, you know, old people give me a buck, give me two. And I was like, man, I can't fucking do this. So I started to steal a little bit. I was like, I don't want to do that. So I started stealing paint by numbers. And I would paint those, and then I'd go to the old ladies and say, hey, you know, you want to get in on the next Picasso?
Oh my
I paint
God.
This, give me $3.
Yeah.
And like then they would give me enough, and then I'd buy the paint by numbers, and then I would,
wow.
you know, just try to do, I'd try to do whatever I could. Then I wound up scoring a job at a restaurant as a busboy when I was around 14. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh, I get paid and I get food. And then finally, they're like, because I would just rip through like Italian bread rolls because
sure.
it's an Italian restaurant.
Right.
I didn't know what a zeppoli was, where they would just take the dough and throw it in the fryer and then roll it in sugar. It's basically a donut.
Yeah.
And I would just, I would eat. And the guy's like, listen, I don't know what's happening at your house, because I couldn't tell him. I didn't want to become a ward of the state.
Right.
He goes, you can't, you're eating. You're eating like everything. Like, this is my business. Like, you can't come here and just
right.
like, pick a little thing here right. or there. Because I would just rip the bread off and dunk it in the sauce and eat like two.
Well, yeah, you're a freaking teenager.
I know, it's just
yes.
like crazy. So I get into this high school, Fenwick, which you saw the thing.
Yep.
And I'm getting halfway through my freshman year and my clothes stink and I'm wrestling varsity yeah. freshman year. And like, I just don't possess the living skills
yep.
to operate at that level. Mm-hmm. And I just crash and I go and I tell my counselor, hey, I got the secret. I don't really have any parents. And he's like, if you're lying, you're out of the school. Like, if you're lying about mm-hmm. this. So I go, well, what do you want me to do? He said, we're going to your place right now. And so we went there and he goes, this is the worst case of child abuse I've ever seen. Your mother's going to jail. And I'm like, listen, I don't know shit. I haven't seen shit. I don't even know what year it is. And he got it. It's
yep.
just like, I'm not here to take anybody down.
Right.
I want to eat.
Right.
Because I originally went in and asked him, because part of my financial aid was working at the school. So I got to know the whole school
yeah.
and there was an old rectory that no one was
right.
living in. I was
right.
like, hey, can I just go live there? And then I don't have to, I can come from work to here instead of work to home to here.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I wound up moving in with my aunt and uncle. And then we get evicted from their apartment because we were so poor and moved back to where I just left. And we stayed there for a little bit. We charged the batteries and then we got a little apartment and I lived on, they were kind enough to bring me with them and I lived on the back porch of that apartment like sophomore to senior year. I didn't necessarily want to say what was going on.
Yeah.
I was just like, hey, can I stay here, live
yeah.
here? And he's like, what do your parents
right.
have to say about that? And I'm like, funny word, parents.
As the outsider listening to this, the fact that you had all these things that you were dealing with, you know, growing up as a child, basically what it seems like from day one, and you still had the ability and the wherewithal to be able to get into Fenwick Academy, you know, to have the level of intelligence or just even as a kid. I mean, there's an Oliver Twist element to your story that I almost wonder if you would go, no way, I'm not going to fucking school like that. No way. No
I was way. Really intimidated by it. I mean, there was a real class divide there between, which is why I give a shout out to the Berwyn kids in that speech.
Yeah.
You know, it's we were lower class kids.
Yeah.
We just were. And there was a real, you know, you get older and those resentments, time heals all wounds, ideally, in a perfect world. But, you know, those kids were, my kids are those kids, you know, and I'm just trying to do the best to give my kids a safe life where they have access to, you know, you want those shoes, I'll get them for you. But I'm teaching my kids, just like those kids were taught, the value of money and of human life. They were decent kids. Some were a little entitled, you know, and some were very entitled. And I was incredibly resentful, as were all my friends, of that. And that resentment probably went until I was about 28. It's tough, man, you know, because when you don't have and you see people that do, you want to take it personally.
Right.
Like, oh, it's a zero-sum game. They have my thing. Or if I had their thing, I would feel better. And it's just, it was an incredibly confusing time, you know, so that I don't want to act like there was, you know, some Buddhist through this whole experience. There was some anger and some resentment. I mean, most of the time I felt great, but there was certainly an undercurrent of animosity for sure.
Sure. How, I guess, I don't know how else to ask it. How the hell did you survive it?
Well, you do what you got to do, man. Yeah. You know, like, I think there were a couple crucial things in I think living with different relatives that were, you know, my grandfather's kindness certainly was formative. Mm-hmm. My uncle's kindness, both before I moved in with him and after. My aunt, who didn't have to take in a teenager with two young kids already, like, did not need to do that, did that. And I also, and I know it sounds corny, but like, I never felt like I fit in. You know, you hear this imposter syndrome, which I still have now, but I can clearly coexist with it a lot better than I did when I was a younger guy. My grandfather was always trying to invent things and viewed that as kind of a way to wealth or power. Right. And by power, I mean like a feeling of comfort in your own life. Like if you have wealth, if you have some money, you have stability. And if you have stability, then you're in control of your life instead of constantly reacting to what's happening in life. Like life's happening to you.
Yep.
You know, you're living your life instead of enduring it. That sense of hustle really had a profound impact on me because I was like, imagine that. And then imagine wrestling, you know, where I'm wrestling and the idea is to punish yourself as much as you can so that when the meat actually arrives, there's just no amount of terror, horror, deprivation, pain, anguish that you haven't already experienced.
Right.
So I just kind of merged those two.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, this is like wrestling. It just hurts. And I'm training. And also, like, when I was 14... I was busboy at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go, it was like freshman homecoming or a dance, right?
Yep.
I don't have any dough. I don't even have fucking suit. I got nothing.
Right.
But I want to go. So how do I go? I said, well, I'm at the restaurant and I noticed that they would do banquet packages.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, if I bring five couples here, will you give me a discounted rate on the dinner? Like, I didn't know what a price fix was, but they go, yeah. So it'll be like $12. You get a salad, a soup, and chicken parm or whatever.
Right.
It's like, okay, cool. So I got a piece of paper. I wrote that down. I go, cool. I call a limo company. I go, how much is the limo? How many people can you fit in the limo?
Right.
Oh, that's great. I think I might have actually been a cook at Kentucky Fried Chicken at this time. I'm not sure. Because I asked one of the guys to get me two cases of beer.
Yep.
So then I started going to people and I said, listen, for $100, you get the limo. It's stocked with beer.
Mm-hmm.
And you get an amazing, romantic, private room in a banquet room and the dance. And I made like $600.
Whoa.
On that package. And I got to go. And I rented a tux and the whole thing. But that was one piece of paper. And it's hustle math, right?
Yep.
Your left pocket's got money coming in.
Right.
Your right pocket's got money going out. You want more in the left pocket than, you know, you want your left pocket fatter than your right pocket.
Right.
Just keep it that simple. I don't know, you know, just keep it simple. What's coming in, what's going out, and just take a big swing.
Yep. Damn. I got no words. I don't know how the hell to respond to any of that. Because it's a lifestyle. It's an upbringing that most people can't really connect to or identify with. And it doesn't, like, I'm sure, have you written about this? I know that you have, but I mean, how is this, people would think this is a movie. It's a TV show. It's a series.
Well, I wrote bullet pointed stories that I thought would be interesting. And so I wrote them all out. And obviously it was this obnoxiously large volume that was unpublishable because it was just kind of a linear, this happened, then this happened, then this happened.
Right.
So I think now it's at the process where the website's going to be launched, and then I'm going to put pieces up also with different versions of the story for aspiring writers to say, this is the first draft, and this is what the second draft looks like, and this is the third draft, and why. So you can see a little insight into that, into the actual creative process behind the finished product.
I'm blown away. I'm blown away. Like, I've been sitting here listening to you, you know, talk, and I got to tell you, I think it's all bullshit. I think you made it up. I mean, look at you. You're really an overprivileged rich kid.
You didn't
get what you wanted for Christmas one year, and now this is just a cry for help.
It's arrived, Brian.
Yeah, you're sitting
the day
here
that I have always worried about, where I have been look proven a fraud.
You're sitting here. You've had a shower. You're wearing pants. You're not fooling anybody. I do want to have you back at some point because there's so much more that I would love to chat with you about that I think the listeners of the podcast would love to hear about from an industry standpoint, your perspective,
sure,
your experiences, the roller coaster that is, how you got, you know, we barely even acknowledge the fact that you're in the entertainment industry beyond stand-up. I know we focus on that a lot, but
I would just check with your neighbor first and see when they're mowing the lawn, first and foremost, and then make sure we're in that window.
And I'll have a big bucket of water standing
kick
by.
Kick the water over.
And numerous times. Good God. Well, man, seriously, I'm so grateful for you to come over here and sit down with me, complete and total stranger. I feel like I've made a friend. And
absolutely,
I would love to talk with you some more. This has been Mick Betancourt. You've been listening to You May Have Seen. Thank you so much.
Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if you'd like to leave a comment or review, that's always nice. You can also email us at youmayhaveseen@gmail.com if you have a comment or a question, and we'll give you a shout-out in the next episode.